As you will see, the special counsel's report states that his, quote, investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities.
Attorney General William Barr this morning before he released the much-awaited Mueller report. As people all over the country and the world pore through all 448 pages, a few things are now a bit more clear. The report shows that after nearly 2 years of investigating, Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his team did not find enough evidence to prove that President Trump or his team conspired with Russia to influence the 2016 election.
Put another way, the special counsel found no collusion.
But the report also documents 10 instances where the president may have obstructed justice, but that Mueller's team couldn't reach a conclusion on. During the press conference, Barr defended his decision to make the call that those actions did not amount to a crime. He painted the president as a victim.
The president was frustrated and angered by his sincere belief that the investigation was undermining his presidency, propelled by his political opponents and fueled by illegal leaks. Nonetheless, the White House fully cooperated with the special counsel's investigation.
Speaking after the release of the report, President Trump said,
"No collusion, no obstruction."
And he went on to say,
"This should never happen to another president again. This hoax, this should never happen to another president again."
But Democrats claim the report isn't the full-throated exoneration that both Trump and Barr described. Minutes after the attorney general's press conference, a top House Democrat called on Mueller to testify before Congress as soon as possible. And Bay Area House Democrat Jackie Speier, a member of the House Intelligence Committee, said,
"What we have here now is a situation where the attorney general of the United States of America has been corrupted."
With that, let's dive now into our analysis of the report. We have a panel of guests here today to help us out. In our studio, we're joined by Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, and of course, a regular legal eagle. Hello, Jessica. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Barrow is also with us. He's the host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center and All the President's Lawyers and a columnist for New York Magazine. And it's really nice to have your voice in the mix here, Josh.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
We're also joined by Jessica Marsden. She's an attorney and counsel at Protect Democracy. That's a nonpartisan nonprofit that's written a detailed analysis of previous independent prosecutors' investigations. And it's really good to have your historical perspective as well, Jessica.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So that's it. Yes, we have two Jessicas and one Josh, three J's. So I'll just try to remember to say at least both of your last names, Jessica, to keep this in order here. So let's begin with first impressions. And after reading some pages of the Mueller report, what your main takeaway is from it. And Josh, why don't we start with you?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think, first of all, the report more or less aligns with the first letter that we got from Attorney General William Barr. Now, I don't think it aligns with a lot of the conclusions that people drew from the Barr letter, including the president. This report is not an exoneration. There is a lot here in this report that I think is quite embarrassing for the president and could be used to underlie an impeachment inquiry if the House of Representatives chose to go in that direction. But the report does reflect certain unsavory links between Trump, the people around Donald Trump, and people associated with the Russian government. But Mueller says that he does not establish coordination or conspiracy using the definitions that were laid out both in the report and in Barr's letter summarizing the report findings. And then it lays out a lot of in its second section, it lays out a lot of behavior that could conceivably be obstruction of justice. And as we learned from the letter a few weeks ago, Mueller declines to make a prosecutorial recommendation about whether that is obstruction of justice for a number of reasons, one of which is existing Office of Legal Counsel guidance, which says that you don't indict a sitting president. And that sort of, I think, gets dumped in Congress's lap. That's the thing where they get to decide, is this misconduct where it makes sense to open an impeachment inquiry and to hold the president accountable through that channel?
I think it's interesting already you're leaning hard on the distinction between criminal activity and misconduct or inappropriate behavior, and I'm sure we're going to be talking more about that. But let's turn to you, Jessica Levinson. What really leapt out at you so far?
Well, couple of things. One is I'm going to just slightly disagree with Josh in the sense that I think what we saw today is that Attorney General Barr's four-page summary and that his press conference slash commercial this morning, I think was a very positive gloss on the Mueller report. I think my takeaway is that the headline for the Mueller report, which is essentially what Attorney General Barr gave us, which was, I think, brilliant in terms of his framing of the narrative, was a kind of gauzy, positive summary of what we see here. And so the summary, of course, is that there will not be charges for conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, that there will not be charges for obstruction of justice. But the details, I think, are, in my mind, hit me harder and are more damning than the summary letter or Attorney General Barr's verbal summary today conveyed. I mean, there were 10 potential acts of obstruction of justice with, I think, serious evidence of wrongdoing. As Josh mentioned, I think this is the moment where we're talking about the distinction between wrongdoing and conduct that rises to the level of criminal liability.
That meets that threshold.
Exactly. But and I think particularly for the obstruction of justice, this really is a situation where if we had Mr. Trump, I think that there would be an indictment for obstruction of justice. But because we have President Trump, there were so many considerations, just one of which was this idea that we can't indict a sitting president, which complicated the issue.
And that leads so well to you, Jessica Morriston, because we're kind of in that historical slash legal realm regarding that. So from your perspective, first of all, how many pages have you read so far? And what are you most interested in? What questions have been answered for you now?
I've read about 150, and I have to say I'm much closer to Jessica in my take. It seems to me, you know, for 2 years we've seen historical parallels with Watergate, and this is another one. Robert Mueller, much like Leon Jaworski, the Watergate special prosecutor, has given Congress a roadmap, a blueprint to conduct its own investigation and think about this from their point of view. Were these abuses of power? I think definitely yes. And what should the consequences be? The report's discussion of the potential obstruction of justice was thorough, and it was all deeply, deeply concerning.
And from a historical perspective, what did you make of Attorney General Barr's press conference this morning? I mean, how does that stack up to actions of previous AGs who were overseeing special counsel investigations and receiving these reports?
My sense is that it was quite different. Janet Reno in Watergate never gave a press conference like this, spinning the Starr report in Bill Clinton's favor. She let Ken Starr speak for himself. And what we haven't heard yet, apart from this report, is Robert Mueller's perspective, not just on his own findings, but on what Barr has said and done so far with respect to this investigation.
Let me turn back to you now, Jessica, because we're talking about a lot of words like coordination, collusion, the threshold of criminal behavior, whether anything rises to that. And Mueller writes that he looks specifically at coordination, not collusion, in making his or determination, which he ultimately decided not to make, whether there was obstruction of justice. And as both Barr and Trump called it, they only referred to collusion. So it's confusing. I mean, explain why the distinction between those two words matter and what they refer to, really.
This is something that has made me absolutely insane over the last 2 years. And I feel like if I had a tagline, it would be Jessica Levinson, who tries to explain that collusion is not a legal concept in the way that we think of it. Collusion is a term that applies to the law when we're talking about antitrust violations. So the fact that President Trump has said for all these years, no collusion, no collusion, and that he has conditioned the American public to believe that there will be a finding of no collusion is absolutely a rhetorical win and true because, again, there's no crime of collusion. What we're talking about or should have been talking about all this time is conspiracy or coordination. Conspiracy is a federal crime. And the question that we should have focused on was conspiracy to do what? So we're looking at two different groups. There's the Trump campaign. There's the Russian government. Was there a conspiracy too? And then you have to fit that conspiracy into a federal statute that was violated. Conspiracy to thwart campaign finance laws. Conspiracy to violate laws against computer hacking, etc. And so I was actually thrilled when I saw in the report, finally, Robert Mueller has explained to us, we've been using the wrong term, that of course there was going to be no finding of collusion, because that was simply the wrong way to think about this.
Josh, what's your response to that? And I'm thinking that Barr and Mueller, they've clearly laid out how the Russians tried to influence the 2016 election. That much is clear. And that's something Trump has never acknowledged at all, really. So is this now forcing him to acknowledge that the Russians played some role in the outcome?
I don't think you'll force the president to acknowledge it. I do think that it is significant that you have both this report and his attorney general out there saying explicitly that the Russians did seek quite aggressively to interfere in the 2016 election. So I think that fact is established. It was established before. That doesn't mean you'll get the president to go out there and admit it. On the collusion versus coordination issue, I mean, I would go back to, there's a distinction between wrongdoing and violations of the law. There's no law that's applicable here that refers specifically to collusion. There might be behavior that we would be upset about that the president should be punished for, either by Congress through an impeachment proceeding or by the electorate by not reelecting him. That's a separate matter than what a prosecutor would decide. I do think it is significant, though, and I think there's been a tendency to sort of gloss over the first half of this report and move to the second part that talks about the president's actions that could constitute obstruction of justice. I think it is significant that Mueller says that they did not establish that the Trump campaign coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. I think that there are a lot of things that people could have imagined over the last couple of years that would have been something more explicit in terms of a quid pro quo, an agreement to work together beyond what was seen in public. Now, the fact that they didn't establish that doesn't mean absolutely that it didn't happen, but then you wouldn't generally expect a criminal investigation to find necessarily a finding of actual innocence. And it also doesn't mean that it's okay to seek to obstruct justice so long as there's no underlying crime that was established. You can ask Martha Stewart about that. But I do think, you know, there are a lot of things that people thought that the president might have done, that people in his campaign might have done, that they thought Robert Mueller was likely to find, that he did not find. And I think that's an important aspect of the finding here.
Jessica Marsden, I want to turn to you with a more historical perspective on the question of whether you can bring an obstruction of justice case before a sitting president. He is the head of the executive branch. Mueller says that is one of the things that complicated his ability to build this case. So explain and remind us really why that would have been a sticking point.
I thought this was one of the most interesting pieces of what I've read so far. So what Robert Mueller says in his report is that there's an Office of Legal Counsel opinion that says a sitting president cannot be indicted, and he takes that for granted. And then he goes on to say, given that the president can't be indicted and can't be put on trial, it wouldn't be fair to come to a conclusion that his actions had reached a chargeable standard for obstruction of justice. That same problem doesn't apply if Mueller had been able to exonerate him, but he wasn't. So in essence, what we learn from this is that Robert Mueller is saying there's so much here that it's not fair for the Department of Justice to come to a determination when they can never put him on trial and give the president a chance to prove his innocence. That puts the ball in Congress's court for them to do their own investigation and potentially give the president a chance to say his piece in the context of an impeachment inquiry.
Josh, weigh in here, because during his press conference this morning, William Barr said, I did not agree with Robert Mueller on some of his legal analysis. And you could assume that he was referring to this decision on Mueller's part. So Mueller couldn't decide on obstruction because, you know, among other things, the president ordered his staffers to do things that could have been legally problematic, but they didn't do it.
Yeah, I mean, so Barr's addressed that in a couple of ways. One is, I mean, famously, when Bill Barr was being considered as a nominee to be attorney general, there was this widely discussed memo that he had written previously, essentially arguing that one of the key lines of inquiry by the special counsel about obstruction of justice was ill-conceived, in the sense that the president could not commit obstruction of justice through the use of an otherwise lawful constitutional power that he has. For example, the president's, you know, Article 2 of the Constitution gives the president power to hire and fire executive branch officials essentially at will, or at least to fire them. He may need congressional confirmation to hire them. And so, therefore, if he did that, that couldn't be an obstruction of justice crime. Now, Robert Mueller, as laid out in this report, disagrees with that and contends that the laws against obstruction of justice are generally applicable and apply even to the president, and even if the conduct that is causing him to obstruct justice is a constitutional power. So they have that legal disagreement. Barr said at his press conference today that even setting that aside, they also had a factual disagreement, that the conduct laid out in the memo did not establish that the president had committed an obstruction offense. And I think a lot of that likely goes to analyses of intent. When to obstruct justice, you don't have to just do something. You have to have you have to have corrupt intent to interfere with the process of justice. And so a lot of that involves getting inside the president's head. And I think, you know, and one thing you've seen Bill Barr say is that the fact that a lot of the president's actions occurred out in the open and the fact that there was not an underlying crime established were both things that go to intent and suggest the president didn't have corrupt intent. Now, I think that's, you know, that's certainly a very controversial claim there that the attorney general is making, but that would appear to be the crux of the disagreement.
And we could talk about intent, I am sure, for hours here. But Jessica, you're shaking your head. And just very briefly, your response and what you think about what we're not seeing in the report, the issue of redaction.
So three things really briefly, and I know we have limited time. First, Josh, I know you can't see me. I don't want you to think that I was vigorously shaking my head. Absolutely no. But I would say, this Attorney General Barr, who was previously Attorney General, I think auditioned for the role with that memo that Josh is talking about. The idea that if the president has the power to hire and fire people, then you can't obstruct justice by firing somebody, like, for instance, the director of the FBI, James Comey. Now, somebody who actually wrote the regulations for the Office of Special Counsel had this great example to explain why that's not true. Let's say I own a computer. I have power over my computer, and I can destroy my computer if I want. If I know the FBI wants information on my computer, I don't get to destroy it. That's obstruction of justice, and I know that we need a break.
Thank you so much for this. And we are going to take a short break now. After the break, we'll hear from California Democrat Congressman Ted Lieu and from Sean Steele, who's a Republican National Committee member for California. Jessica Levinson and Josh Barrow are going to stick around for further analysis. Jessica Marsden, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And I could talk to you all day as well. Thank you again. Jessica Marsden, counsel at Protect Democracy, a nonpartisan nonprofit.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave and for Madeline Brand.
The White House fully cooperated with the special counsel's investigation, providing unfettered access to campaign and White House documents, directing senior aides to testify freely, and asserting no privilege claims. And at the same time, the president took no act that in fact deprived the special counsel of the documents and witnesses necessary to complete his investigation.
Again, Attorney General William Barr today. Here to talk more about the release of the Mueller report is California Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara.
So, first impressions. And let's start with Attorney General Barr's press conference, because I'm betting you haven't combed through all 448 pages of the report quite yet.
Bill Barr's press conference was completely inappropriate, and he made a number of statements that were misleading. The president, in fact, did not cooperate. He did not agree to a sit-down interview. He did not do follow-up questions. So I don't know what Bill Barr is talking about when he said that the White House cooperated fully. They did not.
And as far as what was inappropriate, in your view?
If you look at especially Volume 2 of the report, Donald Trump committed obstruction of justice. If you read the 10 instances, look at the actions he took. They meet the elements of the statute. And the law itself is very broad. You don't actually have to, in fact, obstruct justice. You just have to endeavor to obstruct justice. And Donald Trump certainly did that.
Let's talk about the redactions. Was there more or less material off limits than you expected?
It's our understanding that Congress may be getting a report with less redactions. I'm not entirely clear on that, but we need to get the full report with no redactions. That's what happened with the Ken Starr report. That's what happened in Watergate. And we are entitled to the full report without any redactions.
Well, House Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler is calling for Robert Mueller to come and testify before Congress. So what would that bring to light in your view that the report hasn't?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Bill Barr will testify before House Judiciary Committee on May 2nd, and then we would like to hear from Robert Mueller himself. We know that there are a lot of issues in this report regarding obstruction of justice and intent. We want to understand how he came to view obstruction of justice in terms of whether he could indict the president, because if you read his report, it looks like he came to a lot of these conclusions based on his view that he was not allowed to indict the sitting president.
So, and after that, what do you want to see happen?
Basically, Robert Mueller in Volume 2 of the report gave a roadmap to the House Judiciary Committee to investigate obstruction of justice, to look at least those 10 instances to see if the president committed obstruction of justice. And after our investigation, we're either going to exonerate Donald Trump or we're not. And then we're going to have a conversation with the American people as to how to proceed.
Do you have any words today to the American people who are reading this report and they're trying to parse the legal language?
Sure. The Mueller report absolutely positively does not exonerate Donald Trump.
That's it?
It is a very large report. So I'm now going to go through Volume 1.
Have you gotten to any of it yet?
Yes, I looked through Volume 2, which is really the province of the House Judiciary Committee because it deals with the obstruction of justice issues. Volume 1, dealing with Russian collusion, that's more the province of the House Intelligence Committee.
Okay, well, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate you taking the time on this day.
Sure, anytime.
Congressman Ted Lieu, thanks so much again.
Thank you.
Now for a Republican perspective, Sean Steele is a California National Committee member for the Republican National Committee. And thank you so much for coming on the show.
Marva, thanks. It's fun.
So what are your thoughts on Congressman Ted Lieu's response to the findings in the report?
Well, actually not a lot. It's sad to see an alcoholic in total denial that doesn't think he's got a problem. You watch the Democrats thinking that there's something about collusion still after it's been beaten to death by 13 militant investigators, by $30 million, and at the end of the two-year process, no collusion whatsoever. And even some of the smarter Democrats beginning to realize that, and it's alienated a lot of Americans. It's such a hoax. It's so phony. And Trump enjoys complete vindication across the board. And so this is something that the Democrats still want to litigate the election 2016. It's a losing ticket. They're re-electing Trump right in front of us, and I appreciate that.
We have to acknowledge William Barr is facing charges of partisanship and acting as the defense counsel for the president rather than as an impartial attorney general for the country. What do you say to that?
Nobody buys that. He's offering more information as special counsel than we've ever seen before. He's got a color-coded redaction code that based on laws that Congress made. The Democrats are flailing, and it's funny. But you got Trump haters that are irrational, and now they're trying to put all their juju attacks against Barr. It's just not going to wash. Jerry Nadler's kind of the joke of the week, and he'll be a long forgotten person in the next few months. But there is something.
Sir, it's a little hard to hear you. Have you read the report yet?
Oh, of course not. That's good. That's
so does that mean I can't ask you about the 10 scenarios in this report, whether they raise any concerns for you concerning possible obstruction of justice by the president?
No smoke. no smoking guns. We've heard the Attorney General twice. We've seen the summary. We've seen the reactions to that. We've heard people that have been studying this for intensely. But you don't even hear Ted Lieu talking about collusion anymore. And that was, of course, the greatest joke of all time. There was real collusion between Hillary Clinton's campaign and Russians. Steele dossier.
That's not going to be litigated in this conversation again. But I'd like what's your reaction to the question of whether Robert Mueller should testify before Congress?
Oh, I think it's perfectly fine. I don't think the Democrats will ever be satisfied. They're going to keep going after that red herring. But here's the good news. The hunters are now to be hunted. And the Attorney General, the Investigative General, Inspector General Horowitz is going to release a report showing that James Comey, members of the CIA, top echelon, especially top FBI levels, and the Department of Justice were deeply corrupted and having the Obama administration spy on, literally, that's the words that are being used now, spy on a political rival is unparalleled in American history. That's going to be the story in the next 2 years. So Nadler and Ted Lieu are going to be looking over their shoulders because their guys are going down. They're going to face very serious criminal charges.
And let's end with that prediction and get reaction from our guests. I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Lots of fun.
Sean Steele, he's California National Committee member for the Republican National Committee with Fighting Words. Thank you. Back now to our panel. For more reaction and analysis, we have Josh Barrow, the host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, and a columnist for New York Magazine. Hi, Josh. Thanks for sticking around.
Hi. Sure.
And Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, our regular legal eagle. Josh, thoughts on Ted Lieu's take first?
I thought it was interesting that he started by reading volume two of the report. His comment was, well, I sit on the Judiciary Committee and really collusion matters are the province of the Intelligence Committee. But impeachment inquiries are opened by the Judiciary Committee. If they thought that there was impeachable conduct related to the links between the Trump campaign and the Russian government and people associated with the Russian government, then that would be absolutely the province of the Judiciary Committee to look into. And I think that reflects that, it's not that there was no conduct that was bad on the president's part. I mean, I think, for example, the defense around Paul Manafort is that the president was just being used as a patsy by Paul Manafort to further Paul Manafort's business interests in Eastern Europe. I don't think that's a great look for the president, but I think it does reflect that there is not impeachable conduct discussed in part one, which is about the underlying matters here. I think that there certainly is a lot for the Judiciary Committee to look at in volume two of this report and the 10 instances of potential obstruction of justice. But I think it's an interesting admission, essentially, that the underlying matter, that there's not a lot for them to look at.
And before we turn to Jessica, because I know you have a lot to say, Jessica, on both sides of the aisle there. But going back to you, Josh, looking to strategy, what is the right strategy for the Democrats now? I mean, we just listened to my guest, Sean Steele, and clearly, he's ready for the fight. He's ready to point a finger. Is it wise for Democrats to keep hammering at this, or does it just reinforce the Republicans' witch hunt rallying cry?
I think it depends what their objective is. I mean, I think you saw from what Committeeman Steele said there that, without even having read the report, the Trump partisans are going to look at this the way they're going to. They're going to call it a complete exoneration, even though it's not, regardless of what Democrats do. So what would be the point of an impeachment inquiry? If you impeach him, the Senate will not remove him because of exactly the sort of reactions that you're hearing there from Committeeman Steele. It could serve to highlight the president's bad behavior here, although I think that's already been highlighted to a great extent, including through the release of this report itself. So I do think it makes sense for Congress to continue investigating because they may discover, new and important facts. But I don't think the president's going to be removed from office over this. And I don't think that it affects electoral outcomes either. I mean, you can see there's a ton of news that happens about the Russia investigation. It moves the president's poll numbers, not at all. Things that move the president's poll numbers tend to be things like actions around health care, actions around the tax tax law. That's what Democrats won the 2018 election on. And if they're going to win in 2020, they'll win on issues like that. So I don't think an impeachment serves a political purpose. It probably also doesn't serve an investigative purpose, although the committees will do a lot of investigating other than in the context of impeachment. And I think that may well turn up useful things in the future.
This does make me wish that we still had our third guest with us, because she would point out through history and the 20 prior investigations, special prosecutor investigations, all of the investigations that have followed a report like this, and all of the criminal prosecutions and convictions. So, Jessica, unleash your legal word horde on us, your reaction to our Republican and Democratic guests.
Well, you know, what Robert Mueller gave us was a legal document, but the way we're taking it is as a political document. And that, I think, is what I'm most struck by, in the sense that we have all of this new information. We have evidence of, I think, really troubling wrongdoing on the part of the president and his surrogates. We have evidence that there wasn't enough for criminal liability. And it seems to have moved the dial on absolutely no one at all. And that, to me, is really a statement about where we are in America in 2019. You know, with respect to what are Democrats going to do, I think that Josh is exactly right, that they're going to continue to investigate. But if they want to win elections in 2020, what they're going to have to do is go to the voters and say, what do you care about in your daily life? Is it education? Is it taxes? Is it healthcare? Is it criminal justice? Is it immigration? I'm going to make the decisions that will better your daily life, because I really don't actually think people are voting on the Mueller report.
Let me ask you this, because I wasn't able to talk to our lawmaker or our Republican commentator on about this. Of the more than 10 instances that the Mueller investigation looked at of potential misconduct or obstruction of justice on the part of President Trump, which is the one that your eyes have been riveted on so far?
I'm going to give you a really unsatisfying answer, which is I can't believe that there were 10. And that, to me, was an indication of what a positive gloss Attorney General Barr really gave us. I think there was a lot of discussion about the fact that President Trump may have been aware that Michael Cohen's testimony, for instance, was false before Congress, that he may have even furthered that testimony. There was a lot of conditional language that was, I think, deeply problematic. And if you look at the obstruction of justice, again, I think to me the focus is, if this were John Smith, there would be an indictment. Now, why isn't there? Because the Department of Justice has said that we operate under the assumption we don't indict a sitting president, even though nothing in the Constitution says that. Because, and we talked about this in the beginning, for obstruction of justice, the key is to try and figure out, does the president have corrupt intent? Very difficult to do that if you don't sit down with the president. And that's in part what Robert Mueller said here, is I didn't want to get into a subpoena fight with the president, and therefore we weren't able to make that ultimate conclusion. That's another difference between average citizen and president of the United States.
Okay, last minute, lightning round, even with just two of you. Josh, briefly, your final thought, or what leapt out at you, or an anecdote or some phrase that will be ringing in your ears for weeks to come from this report.
There were two things that really struck me in the report. One is the increasing tension between the president and the White House counsel, or the then White House counsel, Don McGahn, who spoke extensively with investigators. At one point, the president got mad at McGahn for taking notes in a meeting. And he says to him, you know, why do you take notes? Lawyers don't take notes. I never had a lawyer who take notes. McGahn responds that he keeps notes because he is, quote, a real lawyer, unquote. And he explains that notes create a record, and that's not a bad thing. And the president says, I've had a lot of great lawyers like Roy Cohn. He did not take notes.
You can't make this stuff up, Jessica.
To me, the takeaway is this line that while the report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. And let's just remember that when we hear all the rhetoric and all the spin about this, that there was substantial evidence of wrongdoing here. And I think that we need to remember, again, the scope of the investigation was actually fairly narrow. There will still be more legal investigations. And this is such a far cry from an exoneration.
Well, thank you so much. We will be talking to you in the future, I'm sure, but I really appreciate your taking the time on this very busy day.
Thank you.
And thank you. And thank you, Josh. And Jessica Levinson, she's law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Josh Barrow is the host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center and All the President's Lawyer. And he's also a columnist for New York Magazine. Great to have you both here. And Warren Olney is here to tell us what's coming up on his two podcasts. It's so nice to see you, Warren.
Good. Nice to see you as well. Two versions of To the Point. On the first one, this is the 20th anniversary of the Columbine school shooting. We're going to take a look at the history of the National Rifle Association. Very, very interesting. And look at the possibility of really getting serious finally about gun control. Can that be done? Talk to a very interesting guy about that. And on the To the Point climate change update, we're going to hear about the well-paid workers at Amazon challenging Jeff Bezos, risking their jobs to challenge him to not deal with the oil and gas industry and help them develop fossil fuels in the interests of climate change.
Really interesting story. Yeah. And I noticed on your first topic that there's a flood of money going towards gun control research and gun violence research.
Well, and that's one of the things
we're
advocated.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for this.
Okay.
Coming up, most new filmmakers are told to tell a story about what they know. Nia DaCosta did the opposite. She made a film about hardship in rural America, even though she was born and bred in Brooklyn.
I was struck by my relative privilege of living in New York City and the amount of access and infrastructure I had. You know, I didn't grow up very well off, but I had access to a lot of things, and I live in a pretty progressive city and in a progressive state, so I had a lot of opportunity.
So for her new film, Little Woods, she wrote about what moved her, the situation of young women struggling with single motherhood, pervasive drug culture, and poverty in the American Plains. That's next on Press Play. Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Stories about women by women are still very rare on screen. Just apply the Bechdel test to recent releases and see how few pass. But even more scarce, stories about women of color living in rural America, which makes the new film Little Woods all the more unusual. It's set in a fracking boomtown in North Dakota, where two sisters struggle with homelessness, pervasive drug culture, and an unplanned pregnancy.
I went to the women's clinic. And they told me that with checkups and vitamins and delivery, without insurance, it's $8,000. She was sure to give me this, though. Closest place for an abortion, she said.
Where is it?
Hundreds of miles away.
Little Woods stars Tessa Thompson and Lily James. It's directed by Nia DaCosta. And Nia, it is really great to have you here in the studio.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So this is the first film you've directed. And, you know, I thought the usual advice is to write what you know,
right, at least
at first. But you're born and raised in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you come to tell the story about hardship in rural America?
Yeah, I basically really wanted to tell a story about women in a rural part of America because I'm from New York. The write what you know thing is really interesting because you hear that in film school all the time. And I went to film school in New York and I took that really literally at first. But then I realized it's actually about writing what you know emotionally. And in that way, you kind of connect with anyone from anywhere. But the stories and the lives are specific, and the specificity of that life was something I was really fascinated by, in part because I was so unfamiliar with it. And we don't often have stories about women who live in those parts of America, especially not women of color.
So you connected emotionally with it because you were so fascinated by it? Or what do you think the emotional part was?
So that's when we got like deeper into the story, which was, so I was struck by my relative privilege of living in New York City and the amount of access and infrastructure I had. You know, I didn't grow up very well off, but I had access to a lot of things, and I live in a pretty progressive city and in a progressive state, so I had a lot of opportunity. But when you go to, in particular, this part of North Dakota, it's much harder. And the fact that it was much harder, I really empathized with. And then in terms of writing what I know emotionally, that just went into the characters, those two sisters, that sister story, this journey that they take together.
Well, you feel that. And and your main characters, they are these two sisters, Ollie and Deb, and Ollie played by Tessa Thompson and Deb by Lily James. And they're dealing with a whole slew of incredibly hard circumstances. I think when the film starts, Ollie's just gotten out of prison. She was caught sneaking prescription drugs across the Canadian border for their mother who was dying. Yeah. And she was also dealing some on the side. And then you have Deb, her sister, who's a single mom, and she's living in a van in a parking lot.
Yeah.
And she has this ex who deals drugs, and he's gotten her pregnant again. So you're off and running. I mean, they are dealing. That is an avalanche.
I really wanted to try to be as realistic as possible, and in that kind of, I like, the more research I did, the more I met people, the more like I spent time out there, like, you can't really just isolate any of those things from the other,
and one often leads to the other.
Exactly,
right?
That's
poverty has a way of creating that kind of a Jenga game for
exactly
people.
Yeah, and so that's why I wanted to get to this place where, you know, you meet everyone. Ollie's almost done with her probation when we meet her. She's like a week left, and she's like, great, like, I'm almost there. And a lot of people are in that space where they're almost there, and one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and it feels like this avalanche that's out of their control, and that absolutely is worsened by poverty. So it's really important to me for it to have all those aspects.
So you just said you did, when you started doing your research, and I was going to ask you, what kind of research did you do to get this place and these women to feel so convincing? Because they do. They are very specific. They're very real.
I started off with reading a lot of really great journalistic pieces, so really great things, like the New York Times was covering that area a lot at the time. Watched a lot of documentaries. And then I started talking to people, like, on the phone that I knew through friends of friends who lived out there. And then eventually I was able to go out there, and from this initial base of information that I got from all the great journalism and the documentaries, I was able to ask really specific questions, tell them the story that was in the script, tell them my story, hear their story, and just really be able to make sure it felt as real as possible.
And who are you talking to there? People you read about in this journalism? Or
I didn't meet anyone I read about. I went out there and I had one interview to do in person. It was someone that I knew through a friend of a friend. And then I just met a ton of people when I was out there, just like, whether it was like the woman who worked in the Holiday Inn who had just driven up there from Florida 3 weeks ago, or, you know, the head of the women's health clinic at the time. And I remember meeting this woman, Beth. I think we met her at a dog park, actually. Now I'm thinking about it. We met her at a dog park, and then we're telling her what we were doing, my producer and I. And then she drove us around to, like, the different oil rigs, and we're talking to her for a whole day, just, like, figuring out, like, what her life was like. And I remember talking to her about the story, and she was like, oh, it's much worse. Like, you know, like, actually having a baby is even more expensive than that. And, yeah, we have huge issues with health care. People who get injured don't usually go to the hospital because the emergency rooms are overflowed. So, like, all the stuff that I read about.
All this granular stuff,
exactly.
Which is what the movie feels like. You feel how pressed these women are.
Yeah.
And also, which came first? Did you build a plot around Tessa Thompson and Lily James?
Mm-hmm. No.
Or did you cast them for this plot specifically?
So I cast them for this. Like, I didn't write with anyone in mind, but I met Tessa Thompson at the Sundance Directors Lab in 2015, because you kind of get to invite actors out and you workshop your scenes from the script, and it's really wonderful. And she came out to like, she volunteered her time because the Sundance Resort is an amazing place and it's a great program. And from there, like, she was just a part of the film. And so when I was doing rewrites, you know, she was absolutely in mind. And then Lily, we cast, like, pretty normally, like, during prep.
You know what I think Tessa Thompson does so well?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she does a lot of things well, but she looks really tired. Mm-hmm. She does that great.
Yeah. I think she actually might just really be tired, but no. She definitely, we were very specific about the character, and she was very specific, and the fact that she had a heavy load but was just still trucking through was very important to us. And
she's a doer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was really important. Like, her character's a doer, and so she might not connect with her tiredness until the very end of the movie. You kind of see her, like, nodding off, but she's very tired.
And Tessa's an executive producer on this film,
so
she has every reason to be.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Woman of many talents.
Well, you studied film and TV production at NYU. You said you studied in New York, and I read somewhere that after you graduated, that in the space of 1 year, you worked on 3 different TV shows, and the first one was directed by Martin Scorsese, the second one by Steve McQueen, and the third by Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah.
So, oh my I mean, my God, can you point to things you learned from those three that you applied in directing this film?
Oh, wow.
That education you must have gotten from them.
I really admire them all as filmmakers. But watching, the thing I learned the most from working with the three of them, or working under the three of them, or not really with, because I was a PA, but I learned that the director 100% dictates how everyone is treated and how everyone feels and how the set is run and how the production is run. Because I think in Hollywood, there's so much like, oh, if everyone had a good time, the movie's going to be bad. You know, like there's a lot of like mythologizing abusive behavior. And what I realized working with those two people, who are very different directors and run very different sets, I just realized you could dictate a lot of what happens on the set. And also that, like, genius comes in many forms, I guess. Like, it's not just, like, I don't really like the word genius. I feel like it really flattens people and what they do, and also all the people who come together to make one person's vision or many people's visions come to life. So I also learned that, like, yes, these are, like, brilliant men and they're singular in their talents and their point of view, but it's a big process, and collaborating is so such a big part of that. So that's sort of my big takeaway from those guys.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I guess I was thinking more in terms of stylistic things, because I do notice in this film, one thing really stands out. There isn't a whole lot of dialogue, but so much gets communicated, and a lot gets communicated without many words. Mm. And more importantly, when people finally talk, they really sound like authentic people, like real people. There's no flowery, poetic stuff going on. So how do you think about writing dialogue? What's your approach? Do you have to pull yourself back from inserting poetry or artifice?
After I graduated from my undergraduate program at NYU, I went to London and got my master's in writing from the Center School of Speech and Drama. And I did like TV and film and radio, but I also did a lot of theater. And in theater, the way people talk to each other is everything. So I learned a lot about dialogue in that respect. For me, I say everything, I act everything out, and I say everything out loud, and I go over it again and again and again, because conversations can take so many paths. And I really wanted it to feel really authentic. But the great thing about bringing actors into it at a certain point is that you hear them say it, and then you hear them become the character, and then eventually you all agree how the character would actually sound.
Can you think of an example of that, where Tessa Thompson or Lily James or someone else from the film came in and the dialogue evolved, or the scene evolved?
There are definitely moments where you realize you can pull back on dialogue and then also pull back on full characters. And in the scene where Deb is trying to get an ID, we definitely did a lot of shifting of that scene, because it's...
And this is Deb. This is one of the sisters who needs to use the Canadian National Health Service. So she's trying to get a Canadian National Health Service and a fake ID, a Canadian ID, and buy one.
Right.
From these really sketchy guys.
Right. And then so there's all this choreography that's involved, but also a lot of dialogue. And then there are two brothers, and one of the brothers, it just made less and less sense for him to be so present in the scene. And so we started by like kind of taking away some dialogue, and then we'd workshop it again, but it wasn't quite right. And then we'd go take away more dialogue, and then we're like, and then it was like, actually, can you just go into the other room?
and throw your line in from there.
Yeah, literally. So moments like that happen where you're just like, why isn't this working? It's like, oh, because this is actually about these two people. And while that person's perspective on what's happening is important, he doesn't need to be seen.
Yeah, meaningful looks. It kind of reminded me of a lot of Scorsese movies, actually. Kind of that 70s like action film where not much is said, but so much emotional beneath the surface. Yeah. Usually because it's men who are talking about their emotions, is conveyed. Are those kind of movies you love?
Yes. So the 70s is like a really important time for me in terms of learning about filmmaking that I admired, and also things that I thought were really important to filmmaking that I wanted to emulate and to keep. And a lot of that is the beautiful sort of mix of a heightened world, but also really grounded characters. And I think in the in-between you have those moments where you're like, people don't need to say anything necessarily. You can read it at their expression.
Like what films?
Oh, man. So Dog Day Afternoon, I think, is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Watching Al Pacino just like walk around that bank super stressed out, and just immediately you know exactly where he is in life, and you're like, oh, my God, this guy is so in over his head. Mean Streets, oh my God, Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, like those movies are just so full of so much, and amazing acting. I think that's the core. Like, that's one of the biggest things I learned. It's like, you're not going to get anything good without a great actor. So you might as well just do yourself a favor and get the best person for the job.
Well, you're moving on to, you've already moved on. Mm-hmm. This film was wrapped quite a while ago, and I saw that you're directing Jordan Peele's new movie, Candyman. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
Oh, man, that was super straightforward. It was my agent basically sent Littlewoods to Jordan and Wynn Rosenfeld at Monkey Paw, their company, and came back to me and said, oh, they really loved it. Also, they're doing Candyman. Maybe that's something you'll be interested in. And I was like, absolutely. I love Candyman. I grew up with that movie. I love horror, and I knew I wanted to do a genre film next. And then, you know, I kind of moved on and was directing television in London, and then I got a call from my agent, and he was like, oh, you're on the shortlist to pitch to direct the movie. And I was like, wait, what? This is, what do you mean? And then basically I just like pitched to Wynn initially, and then eventually flew out to LA and met Wynn and Jordan in person and talk through exactly what I want to do based on the script that they sent. And
are you ever going to do the Write What You Know thing? Oh, you're going to do that your last film.
It's funny. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, my very last film will be about a black girl who lives in New York City.
Well, so much fun. I wish you the best with the film. Thank you. It's already really gotten some fans. And good luck with Candyman.
Thank you so much.
Nia DaCosta, she's the director of the film Littlewoods. The movie's in theaters this Friday, April 19th. And it's time for feedback with Michelle Aloy. Michelle, what do you have for us?
So we asked our listeners what they thought about the findings in the Mueller report. We did one of our highly scientific and accurate Twitter polls. 6% of respondents said no collusion, go Trump. 0% said the report's findings were bad, but not darning. I don't know if I can say the other word on air. 65% encourage Democrats to keep investigating, and 29% say, I don't care. There was one addendum. Somebody said impeachment. So we're going to keep going.
Okay. And you're fine with damning. It's a perfectly usable word on anyone's
air. I didn't want to make that assessment live.
And darning is socks. But thank you so, so much for that. And thank you all for listening. And we'll definitely see you here tomorrow.